My name is James Cunin. I came today to testify at the trial, which is January 14th. And the reason I was called is because Jerry Rubin, in reading my book, The Strawberry Statement, came across an account that I wrote of the speech he gave at an anti-Humper rally in New York in July of 1968. And the prosecution calls that speech one of the overt acts by which they have reason to prosecute for conspiracy. And specifically, they say that he called in that speech for the disruption of the Democratic Convention. And I know that he didn't say that, so that's what I came here to say. The basic distortion that the prosecution worked with regard to my testimony was that they quoted extensively from what a fellow from Columbia, David Slavin, had said in a speech following Rubin, and implied that this speech could be considered representative of what Rubin had said or might say or what he thought, when in fact they were directly counterposed. Rubin had spoken, and this is what I said, out for everyone going to Chicago for a festival of life. And then Slavin got up and said, no, you know, this is hippie type stuff. What we need is real, no games, but real radical organizing. And he said, it is going to be underground and it's going to be armed. And that became a bone of contention in the court, because the DA paraphrased that as saying the revolution is going to be underground and armed. And I kept yelling at him that he didn't say the revolution, he said it, you know. And that is really funny that I get sucked into that kind of thing, because of course I really agree that he was talking about the revolution, but that's the way the trial, or any trial, works, I guess, is you end up arguing about what it means and whether or not you're justified to say something. But anyway, the main flagrant violation of the truth of what I was trying to say was that the DA tried to turn it around and identify a militant violent speech with the hippie type have a good time speech that Rubin had given. The DA was able to quote extensively from what Slavin had said, was able to question me about it, was able to imply that it was identical with what Rubin thinks, and he was even able to read from my personal notebook on a page that was not entered into evidence, and all the defense objections about that were overruled. Then in second cross, or whatever they call it, when Kunstler, the defense lawyer, got up to question me about what I had said to the DA, he tried to ask me whether or not, in fact, Slavin's speech was a rebuttal to, and rather than identical with, Rubin's speech. And Hoffman sustained objections even before they were elaborated. You know, the DA just starts to rise, and Hoffman says, sustained, you know, and said, you can't lead the witness. And I don't know what's leading the witness about that, particularly in contrast with the way the DA questioned me, because he kept on saying things like, and then Rubin called for the violent disruption of the convention, didn't he, you know? And then didn't Rubin say this and that, you know, and things which he, of course, hadn't said. So that really, I guess, encapsulated a lot of things that are wrong with the trial right there, which was that the Hoffman was biased, and the DA was distorting, and the Kunstler was put down, and so on and so forth. It was hardly fair, even by the rules of the state. I mean, they don't even play their own game right. I guess my most overwhelming impression of the trial is that it's an enormous game, and that what did or did not actually take place prior to and during the convention at Chicago, it really doesn't make any difference to anybody. It's just a question of playing these legal games and seeing what you can get allowed in and what you can allude to without saying and things like that. It certainly doesn't seem to have very much to do with the jury, because it was my impression that the jury was asleep throughout not only my solid hour of testimony, but also three people I saw after me. It wasn't only one of them out there was literally asleep, but the others didn't seem particularly interested. And I think if you had asked them, you know, what's going on right now, they probably would have had to say, I really don't know, for which I can't blame them after 4 months. I think the jury's going to vote the way they would have voted on the first day before any testimony, however they happen to feel about the thing. After me, I did stay around and watch the trial go on, and three witnesses after me really betrayed the prosecution's objection bag. They just, the DA objected to every single question that Kunstler asked, and literally three witnesses did not get a chance to say anything whatever, which I think was probably pretty effective for our side, because the jurors must have wondered what the state was afraid of. You know, why aren't they letting these people talk, particularly one woman who was very sweet and very nice, a nurse, you know, and it's great that they shut her up, didn't get a chance to say one word, literally. So, you know, all in all, I was glad to have a chance to participate in the trial of the century, and after Sacco and Vanzetti, I guess, the next to the trial of the century. And, you know, I was glad I could come, and as far as any prognostication about how it's going to come out, I think that it isn't going to come out, because Hoffman so flagrantly violated judicial procedure so many times that even I, not a lawyer, could, you know, clearly perceive that he was doing it. I'm sure that whatever happens is just going to be thrown out. We're going to be going through the circus all over again.
And I am Jane Kennedy from the Medical Committee for Human Rights. And I was asked to testify because during convention week, I was chairman of the Chicago chapter of the Medical Committee for Human Rights. And this year, I am national vice chairman of the Medical Committee for Human Rights. I had information to offer that had to do with our attempts to reach city officials and other agencies around the question of health planning and emergency health planning during the convention week. That probably is the essence of what I had to say. But I wasn't allowed to say anything. And they didn't want me to say anything because the things I had to say did mean that the city had absolutely no plan to do any kind of extra health planning or emergency health planning during the convention. Nothing, absolutely nothing was I allowed to say.
How did the courtroom look from the witness stand? What were your general impressions?
Well, I looked at the jury and they seemed to be either exhausted or bored or past the point they could receive messages from people. I think that's the way I felt about them. They had been bombarded with information and people, and it was almost like they couldn't take any more in, and so they were just bodies sitting there. I was happy to see the liveliness of the defendant's at the defendant's table. I suppose I almost knew as soon as Mr. Weinglass finished asking a question that Mr. Fran would be on his feet objecting to the question, and the judge would. It was almost automatic procedure. As soon as Mr. Fran objected, the judge consistently sustained his objection. It was like two horses working together, sort of, you know. It was an incredible thing. I couldn't understand why they wouldn't let me answer some questions, like Mr. Weinglass said. This was a meeting that we had for medical volunteers the Saturday before the convention. What were you doing at the Reynolds Club? And they wouldn't let me say what I was doing at the Reynolds Club. You know, why not? I was asked, what is the Medical Committee for Human Rights? I was not allowed to say what this organization is. You know, what are they afraid of? What were they afraid of that I wasn't allowed to testify? Of course, what I was trying to do was find a way to say something. And of course, I was speaking over the objection of Mr. Fran, trying to get some information in. And we did have a little game there, the judge was a little flirtatious with me, which I suppose is all right. But then when I finally again talked over the objection, said that he gave up on me. He gave up on the witness, and he swiveled his chair such that he turned his back to me.
Arlo Guthrie, defense witness at the conspiracy trial.
In the conferences you had with Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, you brought out in testimony that you would not participate unless permits were granted, and you would discourage others from participating.
Yeah, well, I did that. I did that on stage at Newport, and that was like 20,000 people.
What happened in court, Arlo?
Well, I don't really know. You know, like, but it was. I mean, obviously, the prosecutor or whatever he is wasn't really interested in what I had to say. He was opposed to everything that came up about the police being violent as a reason for going or not going. The judge, he's kind of funny. Yeah, Julius. I can't really think about anything else. I mean, I told them, you know, what went down, what I told Jerry and Abby and all that. It was kind of groovy, though, being there.
What was it that you did testify in response to Bill Kunstler's question?
All I said really was that in all the meetings that I had with Abby and Jerry, that the main concern of mine was that it was going to really be a festival of life, and that it was not going to be just a lot of guys getting their head beat in and calling it a festival of life. I didn't mind people getting their heads beat in as long as they knew what was going to happen. What I was opposed to was having it called a festival of life when we knew pretty much, you know, at least when I knew that somebody was going to get beat up because the permits weren't issued.
Patrolman Renault Robinson, who is the president of the Afro-American Patrolman's League, who in one of the more dramatic appearances of the trial appeared today in the uniform of a Chicago policeman to testify about a number of matters. Officer Robinson, what did you want to testify about, and what did you testify about?
Well, I wanted to just explain the training that the Chicago Police Department is going through. The fact that our training for riot control consists of training with the baton, the use of the shotgun, and mass arrests, and that we have no alternate methods of training, no alternate methods of crowd control, no other way to deal with social protesters other than with the baton, with the show of force, and with mass arrests. All of our training, well, we have four weeks a year that we have to go to school, and it's a rotating basis, and the entire department has to go. And during that training, it's 95% of the training is all riot control, marching, riot formations. They teach us how to use gas. Of course, we don't have any actual demonstration of how the gas works except to be told. So we don't really know how dangerous it is until we have to use it ourselves in, you know, an actual situation. But they demonstrate the different types of gases available to the police department, the fact that, you know, how to put on a gas mask, what happens if you get gassed yourself, when to use gas and what types to use depending upon the different situations, techniques such as throw a smoke bomb first and then throw the gas, because the smoke will hold the gas in over the crowd, and different things of that nature, the psychological effect of a shotgun, and you know, and nothing else, no other ways, no alternate methods.
Were you allowed to get most of what you had to say before the jury?
No, they let me say something, you know, bits and pieces about the training. Couple other things that they asked me about were the victory party that the district had to celebrate their victory. Some men from our district, a contingent of men from our district, made Newsweek because of some of the activities. And there were counter charges that they were extremely brutal, and there was a big story about it in the national magazine with their pictures. And so, you know, they felt like heroes, called themselves the Thundering Three. Put signs and things on the buses that they came downtown in, and you know, the fact that the black officers seemed to sort of shy away from this whole thing because there were two attitudes, one of picnic by them and, you know, one of dismay from us. So She didn't let me get that in. They didn't let us get in the fact that at the party, they were eating and drinking, and a group of officers, while one of our officers who led part one of the raids, they said, "Sieg Heil," you know, and stood up and raised their hands, and everybody started laughing, and, you know, this guy stiffened up and got real proper, and, you know, he's a militaristic type guy anyway. Keeps his shoes shine, always, you know, purely military. And, you know, it was amazing to me to watch this at the party, you know.
Did you find the courtroom today much like the rest of your experience in Chicago was, and particularly in the context of some of the retaliation you've suffered for your activities with the Afro-American Patrolman's League?
Well, to try and break that question up, first, the courtroom procedures just threw me. I've been to court 1,000 times on criminal matters that have sent people to the penitentiary. And, you know, I've never seen a judge and a prosecutor work together so well, you know, as they did. I mean, it seems that the prosecutor was telling the judge how to conduct the trial. I mean, the judge would wait to find out what he thought about everything. You know, whatever he wanted, he got. I don't think anything he asked for, he didn't get, which is, you know, unbelievable.
On the second part of that question, wasn't it dangerous for you even to testify in a case like this?
Well, no more dangerous than the other activities. If you holler about death with the shotgun and policemen killing people in under hazy circumstances or improper circumstances, and, you know, to participate in this is, you know, it's all of the same ball of wax. You're saying injustice is wrong wherever it occurs, and I think that policemen is not supposed to be an upholder of a system. He's just supposed to be a functionary in it. If he believes he sees an offense, he does one thing. He's just supposed to arrest him. Nothing else, no judgment. But when you see things occurring, when you know that things are occurring and the system is rotten, I mean, the system that we operate under, law enforcement, whole concept, you know, it just does not work to blacks' advantage or people who have a different political view than the system that the police work for. We uphold the Democratic Party and everything they stand for. I mean, we can wear their campaign buttons and they give us their campaign literature, but we can't do anything about anything else. Any opposing views are met with retaliation in one form or another, through the rule violations or increased supervision, bad assignments, anything they can do.
Has that happened to you?
Oh, yes. I'm suffering from over 107 days of suspension. But, you know, you just have to expect that. If they didn't give me any suspension, I wouldn't be doing anything. I know how popular I am because my name is all over the bathroom walls.
But you're going to keep on keeping it?
I got to. There's no return. You know, you just can't turn around.
I'm Lee Edmondson, and I testified today at the conspiracy trial, primarily regarding John Freund and Rennie Davis. My testimony consisted of a narration of what happened to me and what I saw and did on Monday, August 26, 1968, during the convention. I was in Lincoln Park at approximately 2 o'clock, and it was then that Tom Hayden was arrested. A march was formed. I carried a speaker system for the marshals and the leaders of the demonstration on my head. And when I wasn't doing that, I was working as a marshal, keeping people on the streets. The march went from Lincoln Park to the Central Police Station, where Rennie and John discussed with some other people whether or not it should disband there or go on to the Hilton. It was decided that it would go on to the Hilton. We started the march to the Hilton. As we got to the Hilton, a lot of people started breaking away from the group and heading for a grassy knoll in Grant Park, on which was the equestrian statue of General Jonathan A. Logan.
Lee, you testified today about the role of Rennie Davis and John Freund in keeping that march peaceful. What about the role of the police? What happened to you when you were stranded on that Logan statue and tried to climb down as they ordered?
I started to go down the tail. The officer was in full view of me. As I got about a third of the way down, he reached for his nightstick and was in the process of pulling it out and then ducked under the statue, to which I promptly responded by heading right back up the statue, primarily for the reason that I had heard the sound that Billy Club makes on human flesh in Lincoln Park the previous day, and I just didn't want it happening to me. Next thing I realized, there was a policeman who had climbed part of the way up the statue. He had grabbed my left leg and was trying to pull me off, which would have been a fall of about 30 feet. I jerked away from him, went into a crouched position against the back of General Logan. He continued to climb after me. I spun around, facing the saber side, the side that General Logan's saber is affixed, and grabbed hold to keep from being pushed off. Well, I was pushed off, and as I grabbed the saber, my arm got wedged in the hilt. At that time, when I was dangling there, two policemen on the ground jumped up and grabbed my legs and started pulling. I screamed at them that my arm was wedged, that they were breaking my arm, and if they would let me go and let me get my arm free, I'd come down. They continued to pull. The officer that initially grabbed my leg climbed all the rest of the way up and was giving me very short, choppy blows with his fist in the back of the head. And this continued for, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. It seemed like much longer. So then I heard someone say, "Let me up there, I'll get that son of a bitch." And then there was a police officer just 6 inches away from my face. He climbed up, he was facing me, and he was hitting me in my groin and lower abdomen. He hit me 3 times. I was screaming at him that my arm was wedged, that they were breaking it, that if they would let go of it, that I'd come down, just let go of my goddamn feet so I could get my arm down. His facial expression was that he understood what I was saying, and he didn't do anything. They kept pulling, I kept screaming, they kept pulling. And finally, a third officer joined in pulling the legs, and the last thing I remember was the sound of my arm breaking. The next thing I was cognizant of was being dragged away. My arms were handcuffed behind my back. I was being dragged away by two policemen to a prowl car. I went from the park to Central Police Station, where I was detained for about an hour and a half. I was charged with aggravated battery, resisting arrest, and disorderly conduct. Around 8 o'clock that night, I was assigned to Ward 33. They took me up to the ward. They told me that since I was 18, they couldn't treat me, and that my mother would have to wire permission from Birmingham. As she did, permission got in around midnight, and at midnight I got my first pain shot. I spent it. The next day they tried to set the arm. It wouldn't set. About an inch of the bone had been powdered when the arm broke. So they kept me doped up on pain medicine all Tuesday. And then Wednesday morning I went to surgery, and they put in about a 4 or 5 inch stainless steel plate with 6 screws holding my right radius together. I still have it in my arm, yeah. My case was not adjudicated until 14 months afterwards, in October of 1969. The prosecution made a deal that if I would plead guilty to resisting arrest, that they would drop the aggravated battery indictment, which carried 6 months to 5 years, I believe. I made the deal. I was fined $500, and that was it. In regard to what I couldn't answer, what the prosecution wouldn't let me answer, they wouldn't let me explain what the chant, "Hell no, we won't go," meant. The prosecution tried to make it out as it meant that the demonstrators were not going to move from the Central Police Station. during the Monday demonstration. And I tried to explain this, and the prosecution would not let me explain. Prosecution also tried to suggest that I was lying about not hearing anybody say anything to me over a bullhorn while I was on the statue, which didn't shake me because I didn't, but they tried to make it out that I did. There was a big row over the Helma We Won't Go thing between Kunstler, no, not Kunstler, Lenny Wineglass, one of the lawyers, and Judge Hoffman, who is a remarkable dude. He does look like Mr. Magoo. He really does. He's incredible. He was, I noticed quite a few times throughout the, while I was on the stand, that he was playing with himself behind the bench. And I think Abby was pretty much correct with what he told me this morning, that, I think it was Abby, said that this is Judge Hoffman's kingdom, and he's the king, and he's not going to let anybody, you know, show him up. And that's exactly what it is. And the one thing I noticed was that, like, Judge Hoffman would cue foreign when he wanted an objection that he didn't think foreign was going to make. And he would sustain, all foreign would have to do was stand up, and Hoffman would say sustain. As far as the jury is concerned, the jury looks like they want to go home. And they're really not interested. They're bored. The prosecution is bored because the prosecution knows damn good and well that every objection it makes, it's going to be sustained. And that's what happened today. I'd say the prosecution made at least 75 objections, and every one of them were sustained. None of the defense objections, which were very few, but none of them were sustained.
Lee, to go back before all this happened, what did you come to Chicago to do in the summer of 68?
I was working for McCarthy in Alabama, and I was supposed to come up to Chicago to work on the National Democratic Party of Alabama challenge before the Democratic convention. I was supposed to go to work Monday night, but didn't make it.
My name is Don Duncan. I'm a member of United States Servicemen's Fund and SOS, the group that supports anti-war GI coffee houses across the country. My connection with the trial, directly today, was as a witness, based on having been on some of the initial planning sessions for the convention demonstrations. First of all, to establish my background and my credentials, they asked for my military background, which was objected to by the court. Said that what I had been in the military or what I had done in the military was irrelevant. We went on with the testimony. We tried to talk about the war crime tribunals, and we were judged that war crimes are irrelevant, that genocide is irrelevant. Tried to give some of the background, work with anti-war GIs and how they feel about repression in general and the Conspiracy 7 and Bobby Seale in particular. That was considered irrelevant. I was able to establish the fact that it was a war crimes tribunal and that there was such a thing as war crimes there. We got that in some other strange context. And the fact that we had talked about bringing a tribunal to Chicago relating to war crimes committed by the United States in Vietnam. That much of it was established. The particular atrocities, war crimes, and so on that we wanted, at least the jury, maybe perhaps for the first time in their life to ever hear about, we were never allowed to testify to that.
What line did the government take in cross-examination?
The main line was trying to establish where we had planned to hold this demonstration, if at all. And I told him it had not been established, that I did go with Rennie down into the amphitheater area. And and trying to make some contingency plans. So the major thing we accomplished at the trial and with my testimony that was that GIs are irrelevant, their feelings are irrelevant, genocide is irrelevant, and the war in Vietnam is irrelevant. And the conspiracy trial, if nothing else, has really shown that justice has dispensed, at least in Chicago, in federal courts, is just a big shuck from the word go.